Today's sponsor is Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/psychfiles for a free audiobook download. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 171 of The Psych Files, the program about psychology and human behavior and all kinds of interesting stuff about you and what you've been up to lately. By the way, that opening music was from someone I got to know a little bit on, actually kind of started in the Facebook group for The Psych Files. His name is Shane Partington. And he let me know, just kind of talking back and forth, that he's a musician. And so Shane sent me over to his SoundCloud account, and he's got a bunch of songs on there. So he's a composer, singer from Adelaide, Australia. So a shout-out to Shane, and thanking him for that introductory music. And so I listened to a bunch of his work, and there's another one. Really, I really enjoyed this song called Need, N-E-E-D, and I'll play that at the end of the episode. But thanks to Shane for permission to use a clip from his song for the opening music. So this is a Psych Files brief, and this is number 5. I've collected a whole bunch of really interesting studies, reports on studies, and I thought I'd throw a bunch of them at you, and I think you'll find it fun. Also, I got a couple of announcements, too, about the apps I've been working on and updating and all that. So I'll leave that stuff for the end. Although I do want to thank you if you've purchased one of my apps. Oh, thanks a lot. Psych Test Hero, Psych Explorer, and Brain Mnemonics. And so there's a few announcements at the end, and I hope you stick in for that. So let's dive into stuff I found, resources, articles that I thought, hey, this one's pretty cool. This one's it's interesting. So we'll start off with one that has to do, let's see, it comes from the Huffington Post, and it was called The Red Dress Effect. Women in Red Deemed Open to Sexual Advances. Study of Men Shows. Now, this is yes, they have done a study and found something that seems to me everyone knows. I guess it's just interesting. Basically, what they found is that men rate women who are wearing red clothing as being more interested in sex, which hints that we are conditioned men to associate red with fertility. Okay, so, you know, basically showed a bunch of men pictures of the same woman, although she was in some of these pictures, photoshopped from a red dress to a different color. And when she was in this red dress, she was rated slightly higher in terms of, let's see, what exactly was the that they measured them on? Let's see, looks like we've got a scale here, but on scales of 1 to 9, in response to questions such as, is she interested in sex? When she was wearing red, she was given 1 to 1.5 points higher on that scale. So the explanation is that, quote, women have donned pinkish blue blush and bright lipstick for nearly 12,000 years. And if you're lucky enough to get a Valentine's Day card, it will probably come decorated in tiny red hearts. Very true. It's an effect that likely stems from biology, says Adam Pazda, psychologist, University of Rochester, New York. When many primate females, from chimpanzees to types of baboons, became fertile, their estrogen levels peak, opening up blood vessels and turning their faces bright red. This flushed complexion seems to give males the signal that it's time to make their move. So it's interesting, you know, whenever you talk about color and the effect, the psychological effects of color, red usually comes out, right? It's sort of the exciting color. So, okay. Well, that's interesting. I thought you might like to share that. You know, I was listening to something else. I was driving this week, and I was listening to SoundCloud I don't know if you've discovered this service yet. Again, it's just soundcloud.com. There's a couple of things I've been listening to, and among them is a little show. It's a very short kind of podcast, and it's called 90 Seconds on Sex. Believe it or not, let me just check, make sure it's 90secondsonsex.com. Check that out. This guy has 80 broadcasts as of today, and they're very brief, and they answer all kinds of various questions you might have about sex. And so I was listening to it. He's broadcasting on SoundCloud, because the guy is a doctor. Dr. Paul Jonidis? I'm not sure I got that right. But do check that out, 90secondsonsex.com. So anyway, he had an episode called Lead in Lipstick, and he just talked about some things that women who wear lipstick might want to know about the lead content of lipstick. Anyway, one of the more tamer topics on here, on his site here. So I don't really cover sex that often on this show, but if, you know, this is a good site. Okay, but let's go back to the articles, that the research. Now, here's one. I thought this was interesting. This is from Slate, and it's called How Much Do Looks Matter in Presidential Politics? All right, so here in the U.S., we've got a presidential election this year, and we've got, candidates. One of them's a rather handsome and tall man, Mitt Romney, and so the question has on many people's minds is, well, he looks presidential. So how much does that really count? And it seems to actually count a lot. Other studies have found that, when you've got an election, the taller person wins. Not too surprising there. So here's an interesting quote about looks. It's not attractiveness alone that counts, but a cluster of traits people believe we can read into faces. It appears that voters, particularly those who aren't paying much attention, don't know much about politics, and who don't have strong partisan affiliations, operate like 19th century phrenologists, believing on some not quite conscious level that they can read a politician's character by glancing at things like his eyebrows and his jawline. Continuing this quote, it's kind of interesting. Scholars reasoned that the attractiveness effect takes place because voters without a lot of information about a candidate used good looks to infer other good qualities, which they call here a halo effect, which is commonly found in other kinds of psychological studies. Attractive people appear to benefit in all sorts of situations, like in the workplace. And this is interesting. This is one worth digging into. Babies are predisposed to focus on good-looking faces. Subjects in this study were focused on what they saw as competence. That looks like a competent face. that person looks competent just from looking at them. So what is that? What is a competent face? Well, here it is. The quote, the competent face shape is masculine but approachable, with a square jaw, high cheekbones, and large eyes. When people say that Mitt Romney just looks presidential, this is the image they're summoning. So there you go. Square jaw, high cheekbones, big eyes. And you could too can be president. All right, next study. Yawning. One of our favorite topics, right? The contagious yawning. But did you know that you don't have this contagious yawning effect from just anybody? You're more likely to yawn when the other person who's doing the yawning is a family member or a friend. Less likely to yawn to a stranger. And the researchers here, Ivan Norcia and Elisabetta Paligi, University of Pisa in Italy, suggest, quote, that it occurs, at least in part, as a form of social empathy. Right? And we're more empathic towards people that we know well. So that makes kind of sense, right? I mean, when someone that you know and love is upset, you get upset too. All right, next study, Time Magazine, and it's the Under the Psychology of Money, and the title is Why You Should Shop for Cars When You're Grumpy. So it starts with the observation, actually some research, that shows that, quote, people are more sensitive to tactile stimulation, to touch, when they're in a bad mood, and more sensitive to visual information when they're in a good mood. But here's how they explain it again, continuing the quote. People, or any organism advanced enough to have moods, are in a sour state when the environment is hostile and they're cold, hungry, tired, or otherwise in need of protection from others. Hence the greater receptivity to touch, to accepting physical comfort. People are in a sour state when the environment is hostile. Well, that's true. I mean, if you make things hot, or if you're hungry, I know if my kids are hungry, they get to be in bad moods. they're saying is that when that happens, then they have greater receptivity to accepting physical comfort. Interesting. I should maybe give them a hug when they get into a bad mood, or give them something to eat. Anyway, quote, conversely, people are in good moods when the environment is kind and the time is ripe for seeking out new and better sources of food, water, and shelter. Hence the greater receptivity to visual stimuli, to looking around and looking ahead. Interesting. So if you're in a good mood, then you are more highly receptive to visuals. All right, I guess that makes a sort of gut sense there. If you're in a good mood, then you'll likely be more receptive to their visual things. So if you're in a good mood and you go looking for a car, then you're gonna love the look of the car, and you might be willing to spend more money because you're in this. Well, you think you'd spend more money because you're in that good mood. But you're in a good mood and you see a sports car and everything, and you just get riled up into the situation. So you shouldn't do that. You should go shopping for a car when you're in a bad mood. So, quote, avoid shopping for certain items like art, cars, jewelry, TVs, goldfish, when you're in a good mood. Okay, now if you're in a bad mood, don't go shopping for clothes. Which is when people go shopping for clothes, don't they? When you're kind of in a down mood, you go shopping. But I guess the bad end of that is that you might, now think about it, okay, you're in a bad mood and you're particularly receptive to touch, to comfort. So you might spend money. You might be more receptive to buying some very expensive cotton or cashmere something that feels good to the touch because it's comforting you. And so you'd be more willing to pay money for that. Well, that's kind of interesting. All right. So don't go shopping for flashy things if you're in a good mood, because you're going to be likely to be more gullible. And don't go shopping for clothes when you're in a bad mood, because you're gonna buy that really expensive thing in order to make you feel better. Well, that's kind of interesting, actually. Okay, three more interesting studies to go, and also I wanted to tell you about those apps. But before I do that, I do want to, again, thank Audible for sponsoring the program. Now, I would not advertise anything that I didn't think you were interested in. But listen to other podcasts. You've no doubt heard them talk about Audible as well. Well, it makes sense. I assume you're listening to audio in your drive, as I do. And let me just tell you what I'm listening to on Audible, because I was kind of surprised. I was thinking recently about the book, because I interviewed Daniel Willingham. He was the author of Why Don't Students Like School? And the interview actually had to do with learning styles. But he talks about a bunch of other things. And I thought, this would make a great audiobook, because I wanted to look over some of the chapters I hadn't gotten to. And went into audible.com, and voila, as my kids would say, and there is an audio version of Why Don't Students Like School, right, from Audible. So that's pretty cool, and that's one I would recommend. The other one, and as you know, I'm very into mnemonics and memory, and there's another book that I got last year, which I just can't get around to reading, and it's called Moonwalking with Einstein, and wouldn't you know? Again, it's on Audible. So, and in fact, speaking of mnemonics, I use mnemonics today. And I'll just give you a brief example. I use the PEG word system. One is a bun, two is a shoe. I had to go to the doctor for my yearly, you know, checkup, you know, heart doctor. And so, you know, my wife said to me, well, what? Make sure you tell them what you've been taking medication-wise. So I take Lipitor and CoQ10 and a baby aspirin. And the reason why I'm able to remember that is, and actually I even can remember how many milligrams of each I'm taking. So I thought, oh, this is a perfect opportunity to use the PEG word system. So one is a bun. All right, so I've got, so the first medication I have to associate with bun, and first medication was Lipitor. So that's easy, right? Lip. I mean, that's just too easy. Lip and bun, and so I just, I had this visual of all of me, and I take 40 milligrams of it, so I got 40. I'm stuffing all these 40 buns into my mouth, of course, where my lips are, and that's how I remembered Lipitor. Two is a shoe. Now, I take CoQ10. Now, that's a kind of a tough one, CoQ. I couldn't at first think of something, but Q kind of stands out. And for me, Q, the first thing that came to mind, which is usually one of the better ones you want to go with when you're doing mnemonics, Q, I think of Q-tips, right? So two is a shoe. I got to imagine shoes and Q-tips. So I put like, and I'm on a, I take 100 of that, 100 milligrams of that. So I put 100 Q-tips, 50 in each shoe. All right, that was that one. And the third one is the baby aspirin. So let's see, I've got three is a tree. Right, so say three is a tree. So I put a baby up in a tree, which is a little bit dangerous thing to think about there. So that's the image there. So all I had to do was go one is a bun, Lipitor, 40 milligrams. Two is a shoe, 50 and 50. I've got Q-tips. 100, CoQ10, and three is a tree, and baby aspirin. Only one baby in the tree. So anyway, you can see I'm obsessed with these kind of memory techniques, and that's what this book is about, Moonwalking with Einstein, and it is there in Audible. So they've got 100,000 different titles online. And you know, not just in psychology, but really any of those conceivable genre. So you should take a look into it. I think it's really worthwhile. And you can get a free audiobook and a 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audiblepodcast.com/psychfiles. All right, and that's an affiliate link, so that kind of helps to pay for the podcast here. So check that out, www.audiblepodcast.com/psychfiles. All right, I think you'll find a lot of really interesting stuff at Audible. All right, so again, I thank them for sponsoring the show today. Okay, all right, so let's get back to the other really neat articles that I found this week, and this one was on a blog by Dr. Art Markman, M-A-R-K-M-A-N, and this is interesting. This has to do with darkness, and this is kind of an interesting title of this particular blog post, Darkness Makes the Heart Grow Selfish. And so basically what he's summarizing here, again, all these links are on my website, is that the research is finding that people are much more prone to cheat and to be selfish when it is dark out than when it's light. There's got to be a connection here between this and, you know, the way people act online, right? The anonymity, the term in psychology is de-individuation, of course, because anonymity is too easy to... too common. We've got to make it harder. De-individuation. Got to add a few more syllables in there, right? But you don't feel like an individual anymore. So, but it's some interesting studies. Quote, participants enter a room as a group, and they took a test consisting of 20 very difficult problems. Now, when they enter the room, they were also given an envelope with an answer key to the test and money for a bonus. Participants were asked to score their performance on the test and to pay themselves 50 cents for every correct answer. So you give them a test and you give them the answers in an envelope. and tell them to pay themselves. They were to write the number of answers they got correct on the answer sheet and then take the amount of money that they were owed. Well, half the participants were in a well-lit room. The other half, a poorly lit room. Boy, this is the kind of study that I can really see a college student doing. You know, get college students, do much the same thing. So I have a link to this. This appeared in the journal Psychological Science. What a neat study by, Chenbo Zhang, Vanessa Bonds, and Francesca Gino. That's a neat study. What did they find? The people in the dim room cheated more than those in the well-lit room. They took more money than they deserved, and they over-reported how many items they got correct. So, interesting study, and if you're looking for a study to do, that sounds very doable. All right, so here's another. This is really kind of neat. I am always amazed at pictures that you can find on the web where people say, hey, this looks like a face. In fact, I think there's even an art to this. What's it called? Latte art or coffee art? Where you can learn how to make faces out of the froth on the top of your coffee. Maybe you need to get a life. But anyway, we're very prone to faces. So interesting article called "How Does Our Brain Know What's a Face and What's Not a Face?" So quote, our brains are adept at locating images that look like faces. However, the normal human brain is almost never fooled into thinking that such objects are actually human faces. Well, they have located this in the brain, the left side of the brain, the fusiform gyrus. That sounds kind of funny. Fusiform gyrus, an area long associated with facial recognition. What it does is it carefully calculates how face-like an image is. So it's extremely active when you're looking at faces. So how did they do this study? Very interesting. They get a bunch of images ranging from those that are faces to those that look nothing at all like a face. Okay. And then, of course, we've got to put you in an fMRI, remember. So here's the idea. So we were looking for activity in your brain. So we're going to show you some faces, going to put you in fMRI and see. So we show you a picture of a rock that doesn't look like a face and see what's where in your brain is active, and then show you something that looks like a face and, again, look to see what part of your brain is active. So what do they find? Quote, on the right side of your brain, activation patterns within this fusiform gyrus remained quite constant for all genuine facial images, but changed dramatically for all non-face images, no matter how much they resembled a face. This suggests that the right side of the brain is involved in making a declaration as to whether or not the image is a face. So when it was not quite sure whether it was a face or not, your brain is going crazy trying to figure out whether it's a face. In particular, the fusiform gyrus. So that, you know, that's kind of the neat thing about psychology, is that we can go from talking about your mood and how your mood affects your buying patterns, right, which would be consumer psychology, to your brain, the particular parts of your brain, and how they react to faces. You know, where do you, if you were to study psychology, where do you want to be in that? You know, it's really pretty interesting thing. Some of the other things I've just talked about, you know, how we change in the darkness, that's kind of social psychology, attractiveness with the candidates and why we see some people as attractive or not, that kind of falls into social psychology. But our last one falls into developmental psychology, which is, and this is really kind of fun, babies know a joke when they hear it. Now, this is kind of interesting. The British Psychological Society, the Journal of Developmental Psychology, released this study. Quote, moms and dads use a particular tone of voice when being humorous, and when babies hear this voice, along with laughter, they understand that they are hearing a joke. Now, when I first heard this, I thought, well, isn't that the same thing with your dog, right? I mean, you You've done that. I know you've done that. You don't have to tell me. You've done the thing where you go, you know, aren't you a good doggy? Aren't you a good dog? Right? You put that voice on. I guess that's how we envision dogs would talk if they could talk. They would have that open-throated sound there. I wonder if people with very small dogs have a higher pitched when they say that. That, you know, aren't you a good dog? Or who's a good dog? But you've said this. You've said, you're a bad dog. Aren't you a bad dog? Right? You say it with a different wordage, and the dogs are still sitting. Of course, dogs are not known to be particularly intelligent, but they sit there and wag their tails. So anyway, same kind of thing going on here. So 41 parents read a book to their children aged 19 to 24 months. Half the parents read their baby a caring-themed book that includes sentences such as, baby loves mommy's cuddle. All right, so that's sort of the ordinary, nothing funny about that, which includes an illustration of a baby being bottle-fed while cuddling with its mother. Okay, that's got to be the control condition there. Other participants read a funny book with sentences such as, mommy drinks baby's bottle. Right, accompanied by an illustration of a mother drinking from a baby's bottle. Now, that's hilarious. That's the funny condition. Quote, when parents were being funny, they spoke in a higher tone, louder and slower. The pitch of their voices rose gradually towards the end of the sentence as though they were asking a question. And, quote, let's see, Dr. Hoika, H-O-I-C-K-A, said that by speaking in this way, parents made the sentences easier for the babies to understand, which might be helpful as jokes can contain some very odd ideas, which is true. However, the parents didn't want their babies to believe the jokes, so when joking, the tone of their voice made the story sound uncertain, like they didn't really believe what they were saying. Interesting, because, and I mean, that part is interesting. That's where maybe it divides a little bit from the dog example I gave earlier, which is, so you're not only, when you're telling the joke, you know, in this case, mommy drinks from a baby's bottle, you're speaking differently, but you're doing so in a way you want to communicate to the baby, who obviously, you know, jokes are pretty interesting. You know, I was trying to tell a joke over the weekend to my kids, and they're 12, and you know, a lot of jokes can be very subtle in right, and difficult, and you really have to understand how one word can have two meanings, right, in order to get some jokes. And if you don't have enough life experience, you really can't get some jokes. So it's interesting here that, let me just go back here, the pitch of their voices rose gradually towards the end of the sentence, as though they were asking a question, and they spoke louder and slower. So all ways to communicate, not only that it's funny, but that it's that there's they communicate to the child something is a little bit weird here, right? Something is not quite right here. So in that way, it's a bit different than just you saying, you know, aren't you a bad dog to your dog. Anyway, interesting stuff, again, in the world of psychology. So I want to wrap up here with a few announcements about my apps. There's really three main apps out there. The first one that came out a long time ago, my first app, was called Brain Mnemonics. And so that's been out for a while, and I've gotten a lot of positive feedback on it. So finally, but the problem is I had to hire someone to create that app because I couldn't do the programming for it. And so now I've learned to do the necessary programming to create an app. And so I thought, well, I'll just upgrade the app because there were a couple criticisms, and they said, well, I wish there were more mnemonic images in there. And so I added the mnemonics. I think the hard part is, among some of the brain stuff, is remembering what some of the neurotransmitters do, dopamine and GABA and serotonin, et cetera. So I added some new mnemonics there, added mnemonics to help students. These are really very student-oriented. know, be able to tell the difference between the various kinds of brain scans, right? You got the CT and the EEG and the PET and the MRI. You know, what is the difference between those? So there's mnemonics for that in there as well. So I updated the app by rebuilding it and then found out that Apple would not let me submit the app as an update because the first app supported the original iPhone and the iPhone 3G. The newer app does not support those. And so because of that, they wouldn't let me update it. If you're going to update an app, it has to support every phone it supported before. So I had to submit it as a new app. And so it's just called Brain Mnemonics 2. Now, the problem is that there are some people who recently purchased Brain Mnemonics. It was selling for $2.99. And so here's what I decided to do after talking with someone who said, well, you know, maybe – because I felt like, oh, geez, you bought the old app and now you can't even upgrade. You'd have to buy it again if you wanted the upgrade. So he said, well, why don't you just offer it for free, the upgrade and the old one? You know, offer them for free for a period of time, like a month, and that way, and let everybody know, because I'm in the unique position of being able to, you know, talk to you. And so, because most developers, you know, you can't even respond to comments in iTunes. So this is what I'm telling you right now. If you have bought Brain Mnemonics, the first one, recently, go back into iTunes and purchase the new one. It's called Brain Mnemonics 2. You can just search on the psych files and you'll find all my apps. It's in there. It's for free. My thought is to keep it for free until the end of March and then return it to $2.99. So go in there and grab it. And if you haven't, you know, go in there and grab it anyway. $2.99. I'm sorry, it's free until the end of March. Then it'll be $2.99. But I've gotten a lot of good positive feedback on this. And it grew out of the popularity of the video in which I show you how to memorize it. The video just shows how to memorize 10 parts of the brain. So that's out there. So that's the story on that. Psych Explorer, lots of good comments, and thank you for that. That's actually getting an upgrade as well. So that'll be coming soon, and that will be able to upgrade. And Psych Test Hero, the newest app, is out there, $2.99 for that one and for Psych Explorer. And this is a test prep app, and first release covered 6 topics. I just released an update, so now it covers developmental psychology, another 55 terms. So there are over 250 terms in this app. So Psych Hero for the iPhone, also for Android phones, Psych Test Hero for the iPad and the Android tablets. So either go into the Android market or iPad and you'll find it. All right. So that's the story. I want to end then again thanking Shane Partington for the intro music. And then I want to play the outro music, which would be a great song called Need. And again, thank him for letting me play this music. I think you'll find it quite good. All right. Hope you enjoyed this episode. See you next time on the Psych Files. Take care. My city, she sleeps.